Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
We're going to be in Exodus chapter 20, verse 13 today, which deals with what in King James says, "Thou shalt not kill." Now, that has influenced a lot of people, caused a lot of folks to be pacifists. I think we're going to have to look at this very brief verse from several different aspects to get the true meaning. Now, remember what I've always said to you, that my understanding of biblical authority is understanding what the original author was saying to his day and then applying that truth to our day. Now, in this particular case, because of the enormous influence the Ten Commandments has had, I think there is an initial setting, an initial definition of the word kill, murder, however your translation does it, and there is an expanded meaning that comes from other inspired authors. And then I think because Jesus has spoken on this in a very definitive way in the Sermon on the Mount, we must look to his interpretation. So in this study today, I would like to do several things. You might want to, I hope you send for our outlines. First, I want to do context. Then I want to do word study. And then I want to do contextual insights. Then I want to do New Testament applications. And then finally, universal truths. So I hope you'll follow with me. I think it needs to be remembered that this command is in a social setting of the redeemed community. Originally, this has to do with the religious aspect of life. Now, in our day, we've somehow divided life up into secular and sacred, which really kind of undermines the Hebrew holistic view of life. For this command also relates to the sovereignty of God, as all the rest have. And it primarily relates to the sovereignty of God as the controller and giver of life. Man has the unique image of God, Genesis 2. God created everything else by the spoken word, but when it came to man, he formed man out of the dust of the ground and breathed into him the breath of life. Now, this unique aspect of the creation of man makes man very significant. And as we understand God and understand his sovereignty and control, we're going to respect human life more. I think it's got to be said again that this respect for life is probably only going to be seen in the redeemed community because of our respect for God. Secondly, I think we need to understand that this, because it's such a fundamental moral precept, that it's going to have applications beyond the believing community to mankind in general. I think it was C.S. Lewis that first kind of struck my mind at this point when talking about ancient tribes, that all of them had some moral guidelines, that anthropology and archaeology have found the records of societies, and they all have some moral guidelines. And C.S. Lewis said this is the inner witness of God in creation that we see in Romans 1, 19 and 20 and Romans 2, 14 and 15. That's why I believe these commandments have a wider orientation. God has created a moral universe. They speak uniquely to his people, but they also speak beyond his people. Now, of course, the most difficult thing in this chapter is going to be the definition of the Hebrew term. The term is Rasha. There are two other Hebrew words that are used much more often that mean to kill or to slay. Rasha, the word used here, is only used 65 times in the entire Old Testament. The other two words are used over 366 times together. So you see how rare this one is. It seems to be involved in taking life, but it was used in a original sense and then an expanded sense. And that's what I want to try to show you as we go through this. Originally, it related to the taking of a life of a covenant partner, a believing neighbor, in a non-legal, premeditated way. You say, well, Bob, what do you mean a non-legal, premeditated way? There was a legal, premeditated way. The Bible, written to ancient society where there was a lot of blood feuds, where someone would kill a member of a society, and that tribe would go and kill a whole city of this society. And then this society would go have war on that. So hundreds of people got killed over the death of one person. So these law codes of the ancient Near East begin to put limits on this revenge. The Bible's eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth is a means of limiting blood revenge. Now, in the Old Testament, the name of this kinsman who avenged the death of a family member is exactly the same Hebrew word that means the kinsman redeemer, or the goel in the book of Ruth. Now, this premeditation on killing somebody who killed one of your families is allowed in the legislation of Israel. And so you can't say that this is just premeditated murder, because there was a legal form of premeditated murder, so it has to be an illegal form of premeditated murder. Now, I want to look at a couple of passages, if I could, with you, that I think are significant. First, would you turn over to Numbers 35? Numbers 35, really the whole chapter which talks of the cities of refuge. And, of course, the cities of refuge were originally those cities that were given to the Levites because they did not get a land inheritance. And these cities were spread out. There are 48 of them, three of them on the Transjordan area, and the rest spread up and down the length of the Promised Land. So if someone unintentionally killed his neighbor, an act of passion, an accident, there was a place for him to go and be safe from family revenge. I'm in Numbers 35, beginning at verse 30. If anyone kills a person, the murderer shall be put to death at the evidence of witnesses. But no person shall be put to death on the testimony of one witness. Moreover, you shall not take ransom for the life of a murderer who is guilty of death, but he shall surely be put to death. And you shall not take ransom for him who has fled to his city of refuge, that he may return and live in the land before the death of the priest. But you shall not pollute the land in which you are, for blood pollutes the land, and no expiation can be made for the land for the blood that is shed on it, except by the blood of him who shed it. Now, what's this talking about? The Hebrews saw that when someone was bleeding, they died. And so it got the idea that life was in the blood. The whole sacrificial system is based on the fact that an innocent animal's blood is shed, his life is given for the sins of a human being. Well, that same concept that life is in the blood came to the idea that death, the bleeding out of the blood on the land, polluted that land. And the only thing, remember back in Cain and Abel where it says, Abel's blood crieth to me from the ground, when God's speaking to Cain? Well, now this idea about intentional and unintentional is very important here. And I think if we turn back to Exodus chapter 20, we'll see it here again in, I believe it's Exodus 21, 12 through 14. Read this with me and watch this. Right next to the record of the Ten Commandments. He who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. But if he did not lie in wait for him, but let him fall into his hand, then I will appoint you a place which he may flee. If, however, a man acts presumptuously toward his neighbor so as to kill him craftily, you are to take him even from my altar, that he may die. Now, there gets to be a difference between intentional and unintentional killing. It may surprise you, but in the Mosaic sacrificial system, there was not a sacrifice for known intentional sin. Now, even the Day of Atonement, Leviticus 16, only covered the sins of ignorance, the sins of passion. They did not cover a man who planned to sin against the Lord God. When David sinned against Bathsheba, then sinned against her husband Uriah, then sinned against Israel by trying to cover it up as God's representative, David had no sacrifice to bring in Psalms 51. That's why it says, a broken and contrite spirit you will not despise. Why did he say that? Because there was no sacrifice for a sinner who intentionally sinned. Aren't you glad you're under the grace of Jesus, not the Old Testament system? So if a man kills someone accidentally, and you say, what do you mean accidentally? Let's say his axe head came off and hit a man next to him in the head and killed him. Well, that man could flee to a city of refuge. And if he made it, He had to live in that city until the death of the high priest. At the death of the high priest, he could return home. Now, if the near of kin of the man who was killed accidentally caught that man before he got to the Levitical city, that kinsman blood avenger could kill him and not be held guilty. If that man left the Levitical city before the death of the high priest, the blood avenger could kill him and not be guilty. So I think you see that this word is much more involved than we normally think. But it's not involved in our questions over capital punishment or war, but involved in the context of an ancient system that made a distinction between premeditated and unintentional murder, and also made a provision for accidental murder in their legal code. We need to see that. I believe that the wider use of this, you say, Bob, why do you think there is a wider use? I think the concept of unintentionality developed. I also think that where these Ten Commandments are quoted later on, other parts of the Old Testament, particularly Hosea 4:2 and Jeremiah 7:9, the word murder there seems to imply someone who has killed someone premeditatively. So I think there's an expansion of this word. The other places I would see it would be Exodus 21:12 through 14, Numbers 35:11, and Deuteronomy 27:24. You might want to look those up. So I believe the word began to be widened to all men, not just this kinsman redeemer and intentional, unintentional, not just someone in the believing community of your same tribe, but how men are to act with other men. It has always been my contention that the Ten Commandments are primarily God's guidelines for man in society. And I think this wider implication of this certainly speaks to this. Okay. I would say the best translation of the Hebrew word here is premeditated murder in our modern understanding. Now, I just said it didn't mean that exactly in the ancient setting, but our best cultural equivalent would be premeditated murder. You say, well, Bob, that doesn't talk about war or capital punishment. I want to deal to that in our when we get to the section on application, but right now it doesn't even relate to this word at all. Now, some contextual insights. The 6th, 7th, and 8th commandments are made up of only two Hebrew words. They're very sharp, very to the point. I think it's important that we see here that life, the life of a person, along with all that's involved in life, belongs to God. And the life becomes sacred because God has a will and a purpose and a sovereignty over it. And when we treat other human beings as objects or things or rungs on the ladder to meet our own desires, we abuse the image of God in them. That's going to be true of whether you murder them or whether you abuse someone sexually or whether you steal someone's property. Life belongs to God. And a respect for life and a respect for others seems to be the heart of this issue. Really, I could almost say how we treat our fellow man says something of what we think about God. Jesus, in Matthew 5:21-26, which is the beginning words of the Sermon on the Mount, the longest recorded sermon of Jesus anywhere in the New Testament, Matthew 5-7. Jesus, in Matthew 5:17, says that heaven and earth will pass away, but not jot or tittle from the law will pass away until all is fulfilled. It says that he did not come to destroy the law, but to fulfill it. And then immediately he moves into two ancient examples, primarily murder and adultery, which fits this Ten Commandments here. And he moves them from the level of the physical act to the level of physical motive. Now, the ancient Jews believed that the eye and ears were the windows of the soul. That what we see and hear becomes part of us and begins to grow and will work itself out in our actions. So Jesus said, it's not just the action of murder that is a sin against God and against your brother, but it's the act of hate. It's the improper motive. It's the calling your brother a fool or a raka. that shows your disrespect for God by your disrespect for your brother. So Jesus raised this to a brand new level of intensity. You say, but no one can keep this. All of us have hateful thoughts from time to time. I think that's exactly what the Ten Commandments was supposed to do. In my understanding, the Ten Commandments are very much like the Sermon on the Mount. They are meant to show man his sinfulness. I think that is exactly what Paul describes in Galatians chapter 2 and 3, that the law was always meant to be a schoolmaster to bring us to Christ, to show us our sinfulness. And therefore, it's to show us. And Jesus' interpretation, a proper interpretation, shows us not just the act, but the thought. And that when we have these kind of thoughts of evil toward our brother, that it shows we're in need of the mercy of God because we have not lived up to the standard of God, because we don't respect Him. And I think that's very, very important. Now, not only did Jesus use the idea of that the motive was equivalent to the act, but I think if you look at the 1 John chapter 3, verse 5, you'll see the same thing. Now, granted, the Greek words for murder used in Matthew chapter 5, 21 through 26, and 1 John 3, 5 are different Greek words, but they seem to have essentially the same meaning. For a positive aspect, if we're not supposed to hate our brother or kill our brother, I think the positive aspect can not only be seen in the teachings of Jesus in the Gospels, but I think beautifully spelled out in 1 John chapter 4, verses 19 through 21. We need to love our brother, not hate our brother. For if we hate our brother, it shows we're not even a part of the believing community. Hate is a sign of someone who has not been redeemed. And I think that's significant. Now, I want to discuss a couple of application points now. Even though an unintentional murder can escape the blood avenger by fleeing to the city of refuge, you might want to see Numbers 35, Deuteronomy 4, 41 and 42, Joshua chapter 20. He still has to stay in that city of refuge, away from his own land, away from his own family unless they move there, away from a direct way to make a good living without having to sell what he has. So even accidental murder, there is a price to be paid. Notice it's not whether you're rich or poor, because we read a passage that said, don't take a payment for the death of a person. The only thing that makes a payment for the death of a person is the death of a person. So here we see God's care in letting them have a place to go, but there is also the idea that what we sow, we reap. And if you kill somebody, even unintentionally, in our modern law code, it's called manslaughter, you still can have a prison sentence. And so I think that's reflected here. We are responsible for the consequences of our acts. Second comment I want to make in application. Although this verse does not directly relate to suicide, and I don't think the ancient people would have thought about suicide, for suicide is a modern phenomenon, not an ancient phenomenon. Just like there's no ancient atheist, just like the idea of racial bigotry was not something in the ancient world, so too suicide was not a problem. There weren't too many people that killed themselves. The only ones that I can think of offhand in the Bible would be Saul and his armor bearer and Judas. That's all we have, and you certainly can't build theology on that, though I know that the Roman Catholic Church does consider suicide a unforgivable sin based on Judas, but I think that's inappropriate personally. But I do think that this text does have a principle that speaks to suicide, and that's this. Even we who possess the gift of God's life in us do not have the right to take it. You know, in our emphasis on American individualism, we think we have the right over our own body and our own life. I see that a lot in the idea of abortion. A woman has the right over her own body. No, that's not completely true. I think once she conceives, there's somebody else that has some rights. And I think the truth is that this whole issue in the modern culture about euthanasia or abortion, this commandment speaks to that. Man is made in the image of God. Psalms 139 says that God has a plan and purpose for all of His creation, including man. and that it is somehow inappropriate for us to short-circuit God's plan by us taking our own lives or allowing others to take their own lives. And I think that's significant. We need to see that. This is a strong word in the area of modern society's struggle with mercy killing, abortion, or self-inflicted death. Number three. This text does not, however, speak a decisive word to the modern question of capital punishment or war. Oh, you say, Bob, what do you mean? I think there is a principle that speaks here, and that is that life is sacred to God. But when we come to those two modern questions of capital punishment and war, I believe there are some other passages that may be more helpful than this. You say, what do you mean? First of all, we must get away from the idea that thou shalt not kill is the proper translation of this verse. Of all the ancient peoples, the Jews had no problem with capital punishment. Friends, they almost killed you for spitting on the street. If it was important enough to write into their law, it was the death penalty almost. Very few things were written up that weren't the death penalty. You backtalk your parents, you died. You commit adultery, you died. You did this, you died. So the Jews, this certainly didn't relate to capital punishment to them, because in their society, many people for being inappropriate in their relationship to God and to others were killed. Also, the Jews had no problem with war. They even went one step further and had a holy war where they killed men, women, and children, and everything that breathed in a city, the harem. Just read Joshua. So you have really misinterpreted this verse in light of its own context if you try to say this verse teaches that God's against killing. God says don't kill. That's not what this verse says. It says don't commit illegal premeditated murder. So a man who pushes the switch on an electric chair would not be condemned by this verse in context. Now, the issue of capital punishment, I don't think it's proper just to quote the Old Testament, because in many ways we feel like the Old Testament has a sub-Christian ethic. You say, well, how can it be that? It's inspired. Sure, it's inspired, but it was given to society at a particular period of their development. I don't think you can judge the Old Testament in light of modern ethical criteria. I think Jesus' teaching certainly put a new light on some things. Well, you say, okay, Bob, did Jesus' teaching condemn capital punishment? Well, I think his compassion for the woman in John 8, and by the way, I don't think that's original of John, so I don't usually quote that, but I think it's at least one example of a 6th century source of Jesus not condemning that woman, shows that just to kill her was not going to solve the problem. And I think just killing somebody doesn't really solve the problem unless it does put a deterrent to others. But the place that I always go to is where Paul says, the government does not bear the sword in vain. The word sword there was a sharp sword, or two words, long sword and a short sword, that fit in the scabbard of a Roman soldier by which Roman citizens were beheaded. That verse seems to me that Paul advocates capital punishment when it says the government does not bear the sword for nothing. Now, what about war? Well, I certainly think that man is looking for peace, and that God is looking for peace. That's why Jesus has the title Prince of Peace. But friends, it's not going to come by abolishing war. We live in an evil, fallen world. And sometimes there is a needed physical deterrent in our world to evil men. So I'm not going to condemn war because of my love for peace. But I want to say this. The God of peace will bring peace, not through the abolition of war, but through the personal change of the lives of individuals who come to know him through his son. And one day, in the eschaton, the new age, there will be peace. But it'll be peace based on who Jesus is in us, not on who we are in ourselves. Because the fallenness of man shows that we're going to kill each other for inappropriate reasons. This text does speak a needed word about the dignity and sanctity of human life. We in the believing community are stewards, not only of our own actions, but of our society. The gift of life is both individual and corporate. We are responsible for the physical, social, psychological abuse of our own bodies as we are the physical, psychological, and social abuse of others in our community. I think when we see the sanctity of life, it's not going to be just killing somebody that we're going to be against. It's going to be the abuse of the poor, the underpaid worker, those who are outcast in our society, the unfair laws that discriminate against certain people. We're going to cry out from that because it's the same principle. All life is sacred and belongs to God. This is especially true in a culture like ours, where we are allowed to speak to and to change the political system. Biblically speaking, we are our brother's keeper. That is true of his life. That is true of his well-being. That is true of his happiness. It doesn't mean we ought to butt into his life, but it does mean that we as believers have a corporate focus as well as an individual focus. Well, I've really enjoyed being with you. I hope you'll think through these statements. I hope you'll read the text again, look up the parallel passages that I put in your notes, and Jesus' use in the New Testament. Come to some conclusions on your own, and then live in light of your own convictions without throwing rocks at other Christians who come to other conclusions based on their understanding of the Bible and God's will for their life. We must walk in faith in the light we have, irregardless of the consequences. May God give you wisdom to know how to be pleasing to Him. God bless you.